Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. This episode of True Murder is brought to you by NatureBox. NatureBox ships tasty and guilt-free snacks right to your door. With over 100 flavors to choose from, like Asiago and cheddar cheese crisps, pistachio power clusters, and Big Island pineapple, you'll never get bored of snacking again. Try NatureBox for free by going to naturebox.com/truemurder. That's naturebox.com/truemurder for a free trial today. Misfit Jeremiah Rogers, 21, and racist devil worshipper Jonathan Lawrence, 23, were serving time for petty crimes when they met in a Florida penal system mental hospital. A friendship grew from their shared lust for sadistic brutality, and once released, they teamed up to hunt human prey. In March 1998, in Pensacola, Florida, while quietly watching TV, Leighton Smitherman was shot in the back by assailants hiding outside his home. Amazingly, he survived, not knowing that he had been chosen at random by would-be thrill killers. Their next target wasn't so lucky. Justin Livingston, 20, died from multiple stab wounds, some more than 6 inches deep. The horror peaked on May 7, 1999, when Rogers went out on a date with pretty Jennifer Robinson, 18, with Lawrence tagging along. The young woman was drugged and assaulted first by Rogers, then Lawrence, before Rogers shot her execution style. But the worst was yet to come, an unspeakable act of mutilation that followed in the bloody footsteps of one of the most infamous serial killers of our time. The book that we are profiling this evening is Flesh Collectors: Cannibalism and Further Depravity on the Redneck Riviera, with my special guest, journalist and author and show favorite, Fred Rosen. Welcome back to the program. Thank you for agreeing to this interview, Fred Rosen.
Well, Dan, it's always a pleasure to be with you. How are you tonight?
It's always a pleasure to speak with you again, Fred, and I'm doing great. This is a wild, wild story. I come to expect it from you. But this is one wild story. I've got to warn people right off the hop. Without giving anything away, I always say this, but we really don't want to give too much away because there's a lot to give away here. Tell us how you came to be in a position to write this book, Flesh Collectors.
Well, what happened was I had already written a couple of books about crime in Florida, and I've always been attracted to the state, and I eventually discovered that Florida has some rather interesting crimes, to put it mildly, and I was looking for an idea. It was just like one of those things, you know, where you're just sitting there and you're saying, okay, what's my next project going to be? And I wound up going to, I want to say I went online, but this is like, you know, 15 years ago, so that would place it way ahead of the curve, but whatever it was, whether it was online or I did some, you know, regular old-fashioned research, you know, through paper copies, I was looking for people on Florida's death row, and I was interested in what their stories might be. And that's when I ran into Rogers and Lawrence. And when I read it, I went, oh, boy. And I pitched it to my editor, and it's funny, I'm sitting here talking to you about it, and I can see myself pitching to her. It was at the big book expo show that they have every year. It floats around that year. It was in New York. And I just talked to the editor there, and she said, oh, yeah, I really like that. Boom, next thing you know, I'm working on the story. And then I started getting into it.
Now, I really love the way you lay out this. And, of course, like so many of these incredible crimes, they're in really unsuspecting or at least you would least suspect kind of places. So tell us a little bit about Milton, Florida, just to demonstrate when we talk about small. Talk about Milton, Florida.
Milton, Florida is a small town in Florida Panhandle, which is the northernmost part of the state. It's the part of Florida that sort of juts out, and it's known, I discovered, as the Redneck Riviera, because right above Milton, Florida, and that section of the state, is Alabama. And, of course, Alabama is next, you know, it's next to, you know, Mississippi and so forth. And so people from that area would go down to the Milton area, which is right across the bay from Pensacola, and they call that the Redneck Riviera because it's a heck of a lot cheaper to go there than it is the Riviera over in France. So it certainly gets a certain amount of tourism from those states. And so that was a very interesting, milieu. And it was very different from the western part of the state, the Tampa area that I was more familiar with. This was very rural, very small, very very self-contained. Everybody knew everybody. It was the kind of place where, well, if somebody was a bad guy or if somebody belonged to a family that had problems, everybody knew about it and talked about it. And that's what I discovered as I got into it. And the Lawrence family was one of those families. And so it's a very small place. And it just was a very interesting place to go down and do the interviews and so forth and discover what really happened.
Yeah, you mentioned the Lawrence name, and you said that in that area they would say there was a bad line. You know, that would be the Lawrence name. So we'll talk about the bad line a little bit later when we have Todd Hand discover a little bit about the bad line. But let's talk about just the first meeting you have is very, very interesting. You have Jonathan Lawrence and Jeremiah Rogers.
Oh, boy.
Jonathan Lawrence. And so they meet around a little party, I guess a little bonfire party. And tell us.
Lawrence, may I interrupt for a second? Lawrence and Rogers meet initially in a place in Florida called the Bedbug Factory. Boy, Dan, you can't make this stuff up. And the reason they call it the Bedbug Factory is the Florida Hospital for the Criminally Insane. So we got two bad guys. Chattahoochee, right. They got two bad guys who were in jail for various, essentially petty crime. But they got a screw loose. And they just hit it off in this mental hospital for the criminally insane. And eventually they are released. And Lawrence is from, as we said, he's from Milton, Florida. So he goes home and his buddy Jeremiah comes with him. And, and they sort of link up and they're looking, they're cruising for bruising, basically. They're looking to make some sort of a score. What's so frightening to me is just the chance meeting of these two aberrant personalities and what it's going to lead to. That was what got to me.
Now, unlike the way you lay out the book, let's talk about Jonathan Lawrence first and tell us a little bit about his upbringing so we can introduce these two main characters here.
Well, Mr. Lawrence came from a family where there were a number of people involved, number of people in the family that were had of a criminal nature, and he was brought up without the kind of boundaries one would hope to have, and he got into a lot of problems, early in his life as a teenager, and that's what eventually will lead him to go to prison and eventually get over to the hospital for the criminally insane. The problem is, Mr. Rogers, not that Mr. Rogers, folks, but this Mr. Rogers is, they're both psychopaths. So you've got two psychopaths that see something in each other, and it's another one of those situations where you have two killers, and I think to myself about Perry Smith and Dick Hickok, the killers of In Cold Blood, who, when they link up, and it's essentially it's almost like they make one criminal personality, and that leads to the murders in Cold Blood, and the same thing occurs here. So, and Mr. Rogers, Jeremiah Rogers, he had gone to prison. He put some, it was racist graffiti, some anti-Semitic graffiti, that sort of thing. He put that on buildings and so forth, and other petty crimes. And he also didn't come from the kind of background where he was given any sort of boundaries by his parents. And, I probably sound like some sort of fundamentalist, but it's true, you know? I mean, if you got to have those boundaries, you've got to be taught right from wrong. And quite frankly, Dan, I believe that you also have to have heroes in your life and people that you can look up to, that you can admire, and that you can emulate, and whose values you will emulate. And unfortunately, both of these individuals were not around people who were of that nature, who could give them proper values and be role models for them. And, of course, we see this continually with criminal personalities. As it's a commonality, I would certainly say, with this kind of, with violent crime. And the only way to mediate it is to recognize it as it was when they were in prison. But what do you do when someone has a certain sentence and that they, however many years it might be, and then they get to the limit of it and they seem to be okay? If you're the therapist, what do? You can't just keep somebody. We all live in a democracy. So you have to have a reason to keep someone behind bars. So even though you think something can happen, this isn't that TV show Person of Interest, where you can stop a crime in advance. Those things don't happen. So as a result of their lack of, I would certainly say, of their lack of proper role models growing up, they wind up going the wrong way. But again, up until the time they get out of the bedbug factory, they haven't hurt anybody physically yet. That's all yet to come. It builds and it builds.
One interesting thing that I just wanted to point out, though, it's revealed later in the book, though, that John was witness to one of his other brothers just fooling around with a gun and blew his other brother's head off.
Yes, yes.
So John
was a witness to one brother hit a couple of other brothers, the two other brothers, rather, and he saw one of them fooling around with a gun and it goes off by accident and kills the other brother. Now, that's got to be an incredibly, incredibly traumatic event. But there's one thing that I keep thinking about, Dan, and, please weigh in on this, too, which is, as I go through the personalities of the criminals that I've written about, and certainly others have, and that we read about all the time, the one thing I always think about is this. No matter what bad hand you're dealt in life, you get a choice at some point. There's always a choice between down the road of criminality and especially going down the road of murder and not. And so for every individual who's seen a brother or another relative accidentally killed by a firearm, for example, well, you could have 10 people like that and maybe one turns out bad. You see what I'm saying? People make a decision.
Sure.
About what they're going to do at some point. Somebody, if you've got that gun in your hand, you make a decision, unless it's a self-defense situation, and that's not what we're talking about, you make a decision whether you're going to pull that trigger. And certainly that's what happens here. These are very, very, very conscious decisions.
Now, you talk about these conscious decisions, and again, it's revealed later by Todd Hand, the detective that does this investigation. But for our audience to learn the characters of these two killers, what is some of the things that are influencing these young, impressionable minds, not to give them any excuse whatsoever, but what are the kinds of things that these guys are doing? This is not, I mean, young people could do video games and you could have a lot of things, but tell us about some of the literature and some of the evidence that there was a little bit, or a lot more going on psychologically and otherwise in terms of murderous thoughts with these guys' literature and choice of things to view and consume.
Well, again, it's indicative of the personalities involved. There was a certain amount of, there was a certain amount of certainly Satanism, devil worshiping, that sort of thing. Mr. Lawrence seemed to have a thing for collecting books about anatomy, curiously. And that was very, very curious. You know, what, this guy didn't seem to want to be a doctor, so why is he collecting books about anatomy? And he would, you know, he'd go through the books and he would sort of check off things that he was interested in. And I recall that in one of the books, he was looking in particular at a diagram of the muscles of the leg. And I don't know, maybe the guy, you know, if you look at it from a distance, you could say, well, gee, maybe he's thinking of being an orthopedist or something like that.
Yeah.
But
sure.
But that was not where it was leading. I mean, it was really not leading in that direction. And so these guys were very, they were very much into stuff that most normal people wouldn't be into in terms of the literature that they would read. And again, you know, I would emphasize that the whole situation with worshiping Satan and, you know, and that sort of thing. And of course, I'm not giving away what the anatomy books were about, but perhaps the listeners can deduce where we're going with this.
Well, the other thing was, too, part of the literature was that these guys were serious enough to have, incredibly, I've never seen this before, but memberships pending in the KKK, and United Satan International or something, like some official devil worshiper group. The guy hadn't filled it out, but these and some interesting movies again, horror movies, a lot of people like horror movies, but we'll talk about that a little bit later, because there are a couple movies that are, again, I don't know if it's irony or just incredible part of the story, that some of the movie choices that they do during this incredible story. We basically know that these guys, what's interesting too is the length of time they got for their petty crimes, 4 years and 4.5 years. I was pretty surprised. But anyway, they meet in this hospital. They have this in common. They join up. And then in your book, we have them, as I mentioned, at this party. And I guess it's time for these guys to put some of their fantasies into play. So we learn about...
Yeah.
Jonathan's cousin, which is named Justin, and tell us a little bit about Justin and his disability, and his relationship with Jonathan Lawrence.
Sure.
And this Rogers fellow.
Well, they're cousins. Justin is a younger cousin. Justin has some learning disabilities, but he is a high school graduate. He's about, I believe he was 19 at the time. And he was a very nice guy. He'd walk around the neighborhood in Milton. He talked to everybody. Everybody liked him. He would go over to his cousin to hang out. He'd go over to Lawrence's and hang out. And he would watch TV, whatever it might be. They'd have a beer, a small joint, whatever it might be. And Rogers began to look at him in a very, as a lower order of life. He looked at him as somebody who was expendable. And he didn't like him very much. And it would be certainly, it certainly would be accurate to say that Lawrence was not the greatest cousin in the world. But, you know, they had whatever their relationship was. And so he would go over and he'd hang out with them and everything would be cool. At least he thought everything would be cool. And so they had, you know, it was a pretty good relationship. But the thing is, in that area, kids hang out in the back country, and what they do is they'll go into the back country and they'll have a bonfire and they'll sit around and they'll talk and whatever else they might want to do. But the difference is that Rogers and Lawrence are talking about doing things other than going to school, dating girls, going to the movies, listening to music, whatever it might be. They're talking about other things. There's something inside them that's pushing them to commit a crime, to commit a murder, to see what it's like. In fact, in some ways, and I mentioned this in the book, they reminded me of Leopold and Loeb, the famous Chicago thrill killers. They felt that they were going to get a big thrill out of it. I can't relate to it, obviously, and I'm sure most people can't, but we're dealing with aberrant psychopathic personality, so they think that's going to be a really cool thing to do.
Now, the plan is that they want to deal with, again, you say Rogers is thinking this guy's a mooch, he's coming over bumming cigarettes, and he's just a dummy anyway. But obviously, Jonathan, his cousin, are in on this plan. And so the plan is that Jonathan has an upcoming birthday. So they call, Jonathan calls his cousin Justin and tells him about the birthday party. So take it from there. What does he tell us about this birthday party and the plan?
Well, the birthday party is to lure him over for a birthday party.
Right.
And then they have something in mind. And what they have in mind is murder. And they plan it out so that they lure him in this particular section of Milton, Florida. Again, it's across the abandoned Air Force field. And so they wind up going over there. And the thing I'd emphasize right now is that the Air Force, because it's still the property of the United States government, it's federal land. So if something happens on federal land, it's a different police force that would deal with it, obviously. It'd be the federal government. Now, they're not thinking this, you know, but in any case, they lure him over to this place. It's like a landing strip, you know, a small landing strip. And Rogers is talking to him. He's sort of conning Justin into thinking that everything is cool. And then he takes out a knife. Should I say what happened
now?
Next?
Yeah, what I wanted to, you know, I what I wanted to say, too, because it is important a little bit later to the story, is that they had lured him over with this idea. There was a party. He came there all dressed up in his finest cowboy wear. He was really proud of his boots and his shirt.
You're reminding me. I forgot that. But, yes, that's true. They lured him over. He comes over. He thinks he's going to a party. Yeah.
Yeah, no party. And he wonders about that because he's you know, he might be slow, but he's not stupid. So he says, where's the party? And he said, well, don't worry about it. It's going to be okay. And so they're watching a movie, but there's an obstacle, and that is that Jonathan's brother is there, Ricky, and also his uncle, and his uncle Roy.
Right.
So they have to wait till Ricky and Roy finish fixing a car in the yard, and then they take off, and then around 8 o'clock they put this plan into, or sunset, they put this plan in and go to this field. And so, and now what's interesting in your book is you talk about, you really get the inside scoop on the dialogue from these psychopathic killers and what they're saying to this poor disabled boy. Because he knows something's up. And even Roger says to him, you know you did something wrong. So he almost can't kill the young man because he knows, the young man knows that there's something wrong. So maybe you can continue the level of deception these people have to do.
Yeah, they're playing mind games with him. And they're saying that you did something wrong, and he's wondering what the heck they're talking about. And I think the important point here is that he's a very trusting person, Justin. In a sense, why wouldn't he be? It's his cousin. And the last thing he's expecting would be that something is physically going to happen to him. I mean, up until this point, he'd go over and he'd just have a good time with them. But now what's happening is Rogers is playing mind games. You know, you did something wrong, blah, blah, blah. And, of course, Justin was probably confused by it. And the reason that I was able to write about the dialogue it's all in the public record. These are statements that were given by the bad guys. So luckily we have that material. So you actually, if you read the book, to read the actual dialogue between the killers and their first victim, which is pretty unusual. And
yes.
But it's chilling. And as we're talking, what's hitting me about this case is that this was the most difficult book I ever wrote. And I'll talk more about that as we go along. And so what I've discovered since is that other people who've worked on cases like this, we tend to we block out, which, you know, we're just the same as anybody else. When you hear something that's particularly traumatic, the details, the writer, just like police officers, will do this too. You tend to block it out. You know what I mean, Dan? Because it really gets to you. And we're only dealing with the first murder. And so if I'm a little light on recalling some of that, that's the reason why, okay? Because this was this book was very difficult, and I might even say a little bit traumatic to write. I just never expected it. It just was something that, you know, I just never expected it. And when I read about how they killed, how they killed Justin, and how he was totally mystified, surprised, I don't have any adjectives or adverbs, at what was occurring even as his lifeblood was seeping out of him. It was a real tragedy, quite frankly, because this kid, he had a lot of potential, and he was a good kid. And, I mean, not that should make any difference. One life is the same as another, but here was somebody who had a couple of strikes against him and was doing the best that he could. And then you know, boom, he gets trade by his brother and his brother's best friend, by his cousin and his cousin's best friend.
Yes. Fred, we're going to use this as a pause. We're going to pause to talk about the sponsor of this episode of True Murder, which is NatureVox. And I wanted to just say about NatureVox that I had my sample, my free sample was sent in the mail a couple weeks ago, and I was very anxious to get it, and I dug into it, and it was a very, very good experience, delicious snacks, really unique flavors and unique descriptions and flavor ingredients. It was really a unique snack experience. So with NatureVox, you know you're going to snack, and when you do, you want it to be worth it. Something that is tasty and satisfying, but doesn't make you feel guilty afterwards. What you need are snacks from NatureVox. Choose from over 100 healthy and crave-worthy options to be delivered right to your door. All of their snacks are all made with zero artificial flavors, colors, or sweeteners, 0 grams trans fats, and no high fructose corn syrup. Best of all, they taste amazing. So good and so much better for you than the other snack options out there. So next time you're hungry, grab sriracha roasted cashews, white truffle popcorn, and peanut butter nom noms, or personalize to your own favorites and get smart about snacking. Right now, if you go to naturebox.com/truemurder, you can get a free trial of your favorite snacks. Free snacks delivered right to your door. So what are you waiting for? Go to naturebox.com/truemurder to start your free trial, free sample today. naturebox.com/truemurder. Now, when we last left off, Fred, we were just going to get into the gory details of what these despicable, psychopathic, fantasizing about murder. I guess Satan himself would be proud of these guys. So tell us about the actual details of this poor disabled man. Again, you say he was right to the very end, not realizing why his cousin and his seeming friend would be doing what they did to him. So tell us what you write in the book in terms of what they actually did to this man and what they did in the end to dispose of him.
When they killed him, was they stabbed him a number of times, and as Roger, again, it's all in the book, but the dialogue is Rogers is stabbing him. He's making him think that he did something that he shouldn't have done, He stabs him and goes down to his knees, and he knows that he's in trouble, certainly, and he of course would love to have his cousin help him, except that his cousin delivers the fatal stabbing wounds. And once they have killed him, just like in any situation like this, you have to dispose of the body. And so they take the body and they dispose of it someplace in the back country in a shallow grave.
Yeah, it's interesting. Jeremiah Rogers, you say he's 5'7", but he's a stockier build. He's about almost 170 pounds, so he's a pretty built guy, and he's got tattoos, and he's worked out in prison, so he's a pretty tough guy. And he eagerly, you say in the book, again, from the evidence that you uncovered, he eagerly dug that grave himself. And then they placed Justin Livingston in the grave. He couldn't quite fit, so they compartmentalized him, kind of cramped him into that grave, and then, as you write in the book,
don't give it all away.
One of them wanted to. But what I found interesting is that it's a juxtapose between this ghastly deed and then one of them said, geez, you know, they got those new Doritos 3D chips. I'd like to try those. So that was their next. The next goal was to try those specific Doritos. Potato chips. So.
But see, that again, yeah, and what that shows, of course, is that there is no empathy. There is no empathy. There is no feeling for Justin as a human being, which, again, is very, very typical kind of murderers, where they can't relate. And so to them, they get their kick doing it. And then what's the next thing that happens? The next elemental thing that happens is, oh, I'm hungry. Let's get some Doritos. You know, I'm sure the Doritos people are not going to like that very much. But in any case, you know, that's what they decide to do. And, you know, they're able to do this and then go to sleep and, you know, not worry about it. I mean, it's ridiculous when you think about it. I mean, not ridiculous, but it's unfathomable. You know, it's unfathomable. And this is just the beginning.
Now, meanwhile, again, you always do this meanwhile, you cut away back to Elizabeth Livingston and her boyfriend, Corey Little, Liddell, and basically they're, you know, just beginning nightmare. So they know that Justin's supposed to come back for his medication. He's schizophrenic and he's ADD, and he does understand he needs the medication, and it's very, very unusual for him not to be back. And so what do they do? They contact police?
They contact the police. They contact, you know, they try to backtrack his movements through the neighborhood. They wind up talking to the bad guys, who of course are specifically Mr. Livingston, and not Livingston, Mr. Lawrence, Livingston Lawrence. Boy, it gets confusing sometimes. And again, because of the fact these guys are liars. So I mean, they're you know, like many killers, they're great con men. And of course, the family is tremendously worried about where this kid went. Like you said, you know, he needs his medication, and they notify the police, and the police start an investigation, and it really doesn't go anyplace, at least at first.
What's fascinating about this book is, again, all the amazing characters that come out of this tragedy, and out of necessity they become detectives on their own and do the work of police before the police can even get to it. So Elizabeth Livingston says, well, I'm going to take matters into my own hands, and she makes up a poster, and on this poster's description of her boy, but also a couple contact numbers with Jonathan Lawrence's number and Jeremiah Rogers' number. So with this effort, then what happens in terms of this poster and the result of that poster?
Well, I mean, what's the result of the poster? The result of you know, they're trying to, again, they wind up being able to figure out through information that they get that Justin had gone over to Lawrence's house. So the question becomes, well, what happened after he went to Lawrence's house? And of course, Lawrence is not going to say anything. He's going to lie through his teeth, which is exactly what happens. He says that the kid went to rent a video. So this is, you know, we're going back a couple of years, so people could still rent videos and videotapes. And the police keep trying to track it that way. They're sending him on a wild goose chase, obviously. And while that is happening, Mr. Rogers has his eye on a young girl. So that is also happening at the same time, a young girl who works in a nearby convenience store.
What's interesting is Elizabeth Livingston, though, with the poster, has those contact numbers, and those two characters mm-hmm. come by her house and say, listen, we want you to right. take our names off of those posters, mm-hmm. which had a little light bulb go off in Elizabeth's mind to say, these characters are involved. They have something to do with this. So she's the first person that could almost definitively sense that there was something with them.
Well, she tumbles to it, but it still doesn't mean anything without any sort of evidence. So sure, she tumbles to it. And again, you know, she would know that the, you know, obviously she knows the family. So she tumbles to it about they're involved in some way. But does any parent want to believe that their missing child is dead, let alone that their cousin had anything to do with it? And, of course, that's the challenge for the police, which is to try to find a way to put this together. You've got to have evidence. You can't, you know, just because these two guys serve time in a criminal hospital, sure, they would be suspects, but that's all it is. I mean, you still have to have some sort of evidence. You know, you could probably make an argument that, well, it doesn't make any difference, they should have arrested them. Well, no, that's not the way the system works, you know? The way the system works is you got to have something. You've got to have evidence. You've got to have something physical or a confession or something of that nature. And they don't have anything. And that is the real tragedy, is that these guys were smart enough to cover their tracks. And yes, they did go over and say to Mrs. Livingston, take our names off, et cetera, et cetera. And sure, that would point the finger of suspicion at them. That's all it is the finger of suspicion. That's the frustrating part. And that's the part that really hurt as I was writing the book, because I don't know how it is with anybody else, but I start living some of it. You know what I mean? Thinking about what's it like to be bending down there and your cousin's over you, you know, with a knife. I mean, I'm just talking about what the victim was thinking about, what the victim was feeling. I mean, we all have problematic relatives that, you know, problematic relationships with relatives. I mean, we all do, including me. But does that mean that one of them would kill me? Let's see, I'm a true crime author. Let me think. Would any of them kill me? No, I don't think so. But I do have a cousin who's a crazy cop, but that's another story. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry, a crazy former cop. But he's not listening, so who cares?
There you go. Now, one of the heroic characters in this book, if there is one, is Detective Hand. And
yes.
Todd is in 1997. You write what he's doing is he's working in security. He had followed his ex-wife to be with his child, to have more access to his child, so he had quit a job he loved as a detective, and went to Pennsylvania, and at the time you introduced this character, Todd is working and having a pretty good time, and he meets Michael Keaton working on the set of the movie Desperate Measures. So after this meeting with Michael Keaton, he comes to a revelation. Maybe tell us about that and how he comes to be involved, inextricably involved in this case.
Well, just that Todd... in fact, I spoke with Todd. He called me up recently. He was giving a presentation on this case to some police organization. And Todd, the thing I would simply say is that Todd is, first, he's a very, very smart guy. Very smart guy. He is a person who takes responsibility for his actions and for his children. He feels that he can make a contribution in law enforcement. And again, you point, as I mentioned, he wanted to be closer to his child, so he winds up moving down to Florida. He was working as a detective, and in that area, in that county, And later on, he winds up, I'm not giving anything away, it's not in the book, but I'm just saying that he progresses, you know, and he winds up being like, you know, he's like a lieutenant or a captain of detectives right now on the west coast of Florida, and he works for the state. So he just has this calling to help people as a police officer, and he certainly has a talent for it.
Had the first case that he works, he's handed the case about Justin Livingston. He reviews that case. He goes to work. He starts trying to track down, eliminate where Justin could have been in the last place he could have been. He goes to the video store. So he finds a neighbor named Jim Kelly, and Jim Kelly says that he witnessed a truck stop, drop Justin off, wait a few minutes. Justin went back into the truck. When he's speaking to Elizabeth, Elizabeth says, well, that sounds like Ricky Lawrence's truck. He lives with his brother, Jonathan. So now Todd Hand tries to contact Jonathan Lawrence, Jeremiah Rogers. What is his first impressions and the contacts with these guys? He doesn't speak to them face-to-face. So what's his impression like? What does he get from this meeting or these conversations with these two characters?
Doesn't trust him. I mean, you know, he doesn't trust them, and they're trying to put him off, and they're trying to BS him about Justin. So he's suspicious. But again, we got a big problem. It's called evidence, and you know they're not about to admit to anything. They're really not about to do something like that. So he's terribly, terribly frustrated. In fact, he was telling me the other day when I spoke with him, or a couple of weeks ago, that he still regrets that he wasn't able to put the case together against them earlier for Justin's deaths, which would have prevented another crime from happening. See, that's what's so interesting to me, Dan, which is, I don't know how it is in other places, okay? I can just tell you that the police officers I've dealt with in Florida, there is a level of professionalism and a level of humanity that I found here. And I can't explain it. I honestly can't explain it. But every police officer, every prosecutor I've met in Florida has had that kind of commitment. I don't know, you know, you're a writer. You can come up with the right word. and so he's very, very, very frustrated. And of course, he knows that if they are involved, they could easily do this again. But again, what are you going to do? You got to have evidence. You got to have a confession. Got to have something. So he's doing his interviews with the people around these guys, and eventually he talks to these guys, but it doesn't make any difference. It doesn't make any difference. I mean, all the details are in the book, but it doesn't, you know, the point is, what do you do? You know, and unless it's a TV series like Person of Interest, there I go again, promoting CBS. I think they should pay me some money. unless you can stop a crime before it happens, what do you do? You know, that's the hard thing about this. You know what I mean? I mean, when you're a cop and you know you got the bad guys and you know that they're involved in something.
Fascinating is Todd, again, as it's always a meanwhile in this juxtaposition between law and disorder here. While he is, and he goes to these lengths, like you say, he can only do so much, but they try everything. They do voice stress analysis, which is, again, I learn a lot from this book in itself, in terms of this is supposed to be more accurate than a lie detector test, and you're actually, your body temperature raises to this certain levels that can be detected and be regarded as lying. So they give Jonathan Lawrence, he submits to it. Todd Hand says, listen, I think this guy's more helpful. This is the guy I'm going to go for. their stories are line up completely, but Todd is very suspicious because he knows that the movie they said they were watching, ironically, is The
right.
Shining with Jack Nicholson, right. and they claim, both of them, that supposedly at the climax of the movie, which he wanted to watch this movie, Justin, apparently this guy that really wanted to watch this movie got up
right.
before the climax and went to go rent another movie.
That's
so
right.
Todd Haynes doesn't believe it.
Sure, because it makes absolute sense, because in that particular, that's a Stanley Kubrick film, and in that film, the climax of the film, sorry, folks, I feel comfortable giving it away. The movie's 30-some-odd
yeah.
years old. And besides, read the book. The ending is much better in the book, by the way. But anyway, in the ending of the film, you're talking about Nicholson's character has gone nutty, and you're waiting to see what's going to happen. And, of course, he goes after his son in the film. Talk about a betrayal, okay? And we won't give away that final closing, right? But that's the sort of thing you wait around for. You know, you're sitting on the edge of your seat waiting to see what's going to happen. And suddenly Justin leaves? Well, yeah, Todd's right. It doesn't make any sense, especially considering it was a Stanley Kubrick film, for God's sakes. Kubrick's the kind of guy that when he made a movie, you sat with your you-know-what in the chair. So,
yeah.
I mean, that's one of the things I noticed. And so, in any case, we're back to square one, essentially. We're back to square one. We got to wait it out.
Now, these psychopaths don't seem to feel this heat. Jeremiah Rogers and Jonathan Lawrence and Todd Haynes on them, and he's done a voice stress analysis. They're being asked to come in and be questioned, and
right.
yet they're planning something else. And like you had mentioned just a few minutes before, Jeremiah Rogers spotted a young girl that's just getting out of high school. She works at a convenience store that her uncle has something to do with. She's got red hair. She's a vivacious, fun girl, but not an experienced girl, and she's from a good family, and Jeremiah Rogers meets her at the corner store. So tell us a little bit more about this.
Sure. This is the hard part. I'll do the best I can. Close to Jennifer's mom, and it happens. You get close to the families of victims. When you talk to them, because you want to find out what the victim was about, so you can paint it accurately. And what happens is Jennifer Robinson is working in this convenience store, and Rogers comes in, and he's a really convincing dude. He's a con man, and he decides eventually to ask her out on a date. And Jennifer says, "You got to come to the house and meet my mom." And Rogers, again, he's so smart because he's got tattoos all over the place, as you mentioned. But when he comes over to pick her up for the date, he's wearing long sleeves. So Jennifer's mom can't see that, and of course some of them are prison tattoos. And he just seems like a very well-spoken young man. The mom says, "Oh, that's cool," and she's 18 years old, and I wouldn't, there's no evidence she was very experienced with boys, but I mean, she's 18 years old, for God's sakes. So they decide they're just going to, go out, and Rogers BS's the mom with some story. I don't recall what it is, but it doesn't make any difference. And what happens is, now this is where it gets dicey here, Dan, and interrupt any time you want. When she gets to that, she sees, gets to the car, it's Mr. Lawrence is there. And so he's coming along. So it's just essentially like he's the best buddy of, it's his best buddy, and he says, he'll come along too, whatever. And she gets in. So I think maybe the first thing we should say here is, if your child is going on a date and is going to start dating, tell your child to make sure that if the boyfriend pulls a fast one, like another dude's in the, I don't want to see anything happen to anybody because this girl does get in. And what happens is, this is where I discovered this thing. I'd never heard it. I'd never heard of Everclear. Did you ever hear of that?
Yeah.
Everclear? I must be the most naive guy in the world. I didn't realize it was pure alcohol. And there's no real taste to it. And so what Mr. Rogers does is, every time I say that, I'm thinking of Fred Rogers. Please forgive me, Fred. And but what Jeremiah Rogers does is he spikes her drink with Everclear. And the drink is, I don't know, I can't, it's like 7-Up or, you know, whatever it is. And they wind up going out into the canebrake, the Florida Panhandle, which means they're in the middle of no place with a lot of bushes and trees and all that other stuff. And she gets loaded to the point that she doesn't really offer any, according to Rogers, resistance when he sexually assaults her. And then Mr. Lawrence does the same thing. And she gets out of the car. And he wants to show her something. I think what he says is he wants to show her some marijuana or something like that. You know, that's
right.
You know, that's been what he called planted someplace, which wouldn't be unusual, nearby. And they, and what she doesn't realize is he's got a weapon. He's got a gun. And they walk down. She follows him to where this marijuana patch is supposed to be, and she's wondering where it is. And he takes out the gun and shoots her. You can read all the details in the book. But that's just the beginning.
We won't go into... That's good. What we'll do, though, is that... I'm just going to go backwards just a slight bit. What's interesting is while Romeo Jeremiah Rogers is picking up his date, he's trying to avoid, like the plague, meeting the mother. But she insists,
right.
Oh, no, my mother has to meet you. So they meet.
That's right, yeah.
But meanwhile, what you have, and this is going to be, you can't get any more striking evidence. You really can't. John Lawrence is making a list and checking it twice. Number one, cooler of ice for her meat.
That's right.
Two, strawberry wine. Three, Everclear. Four, he needs to clean the blade and clean the saw and tomahawk. He wants to sharpen the blade and clean the saw and tomahawk. A film for Polaroid camera. Gallon size,
right.
Ziploc bags. Wants wash rags, rope, jug of water, extra round post shovel. And he put all that in his trunk.
That's right. That's right. And he's, of course, that you're right. You can't get any better than that for evidence. They're planning this out. Now, why? Boy, that's a whole other story. There's a reason why these guys are in the bedbug factory. So, yes, I mean, he's planning all this out, and this also goes back to what we mentioned earlier about his anatomy books. And a couple of things happen after she's shot. Mr. Lawrence commits necrophilia. And then, should I keep going?
Sure.
I guess
yeah.
So. And then what he does is he puts into action what he has read in those books, and he fillets one of Jennifer's calf muscles and cuts out part of the calf muscle, puts it in the cooler. purpose of that is to take it home and cook it and eat it. And then, of course, they bury the body in a shallow grave. And then they leave, just like nothing has happened. And now, two young lives have been lost to these individuals, these criminals.
It's amazing, too. He goes home, and of course, he wants to unwind after the murder. So he pops in a video, and he watches the Donner Party. Just tell our audience, again, ultimate irony, I mean, what's the Donner Party about, if you don't know?
The Donner Party was a group of pioneers who were trying to go through the Sierra Madre Mountains in the middle 1800s, and they hit bad snows, and they could not get through, and as a result, they had to lay over until things got the weather got better, and as people would die, they would eat them in order to survive. They would cannibalize the individuals in order to survive. So it, there's certainly a certain irony in that he's watching that movie after what just happened to Jennifer.
Incredible. Now, again, meanwhile, Dennis Randall is waking up. Diane believes her daughter went out. The next day, she had a skip senior day, so she didn't have to go to school. But she was up. And Diane's boyfriend, Dennis Randall, looked in on Jennifer, Jenny, and she wasn't there. So she hadn't made it home. So the panic began for Diane and Dennis. There was a clerk at the store where she worked, where Jenny worked.
Right.
And Elijah walked in, and she said, "Have you seen Jenny?" Because she didn't come home last night. She told him that Jenny had gone out with Jeremiah Rogers.
Right. That, of course,
which again, Elijah is his brother.
Right.
We've got to say. So this is through Elijah is his brother. Now he hears about this story, and Elijah goes and tries to find Jeremiah, find out what's going on. So what happens when he finds him, and what does Jeremiah tell him about Jonathan's involvement and Jennifer?
Boy, you know what? I wrote the book and I'm blanking. But well, basically he's lying through his teeth. Anything he's going to say, he's going to lie through his teeth. He claims that he dropped her off someplace the night before. He claims that he dropped her off someplace the night before. And that's basically it in a nutshell. He just lied through his teeth. Nothing happened.
Well, there's an incredible, again, this story just gets wilder and more wild as you go on. And
yeah,
so it's hard to remember everything, but I just read this really fresh, so that's why I have the advantage.
Right.
But what he does, too, is when he sees his brother, Jeremiah Rogers, the twisted psychopath that he is, pulls out about 10 Polaroids. Remember, we made sure they had a Polaroid camera. So he hands his brother these Polaroids. What are on these Polaroids, of course? The
what's
kinds
on the
of
Polaroid?
Anyway. Yeah.
Death.
Yeah, mutilation.
What's up? Mutilation, death. That's what's on those Polaroids. I mean, the guy is nuts. The guy is just absolutely out of his mind. First off, if his brother now has knowledge about this, which makes him an accessory after the fact, if he doesn't, you know, if in any way he helps his brother. So, the reason that they bring that, you know, the camera, well, boy, we're talking about old technology, Polaroid, is, you know, hey, we got to get some pictures of the murder, and we got to get some pictures of the mutilation, And, you know, we need some souvenirs. We need to take that stuff home. We need to show everybody.
Yeah.
It's pretty crazy.
Yeah. And you, what you really talk about, too, and you make this point because it's true, is that Rogers seemed to really covet these Polaroids as prized possessions. He was even wiping the dirt off to make sure there was no smudges so he could put them back in his pocket. And Elijah is overwhelmed and says, listen, Jeremiah says, listen, I'll take you to the bodies. Come into the woods, and I'll take you to where the bodies are. And Elijah's going, no. Listen, we got to go see our other brother, Lamar. And so they go see Lamar. Again, Jeremiah pulls out his prized possessions, tries to give him the photos. Lamar looks at the first one. You know, he didn't look at any other than just the first photo. He said, that's enough. I don't want to see these. And they said they had to do the responsible thing. You know, there was another person named Wicks that was involved. These people just decided that this was way beyond any kind of loyalty, that they needed to get the police involved. They also said, listen, you got to go talk to Jenny's mother, because another horrific part of this was the response that she got, Jenny's mother, from calling Jeremiah. Jeremiah at first pretended that he didn't even know who she was. Then he said, listen, I'm not effing responsible for your daughter. So her nightmare was being exacerbated. Not only she thinks she's missing, she might have been raped, and here's this callous clown that's obviously involved. So,
well, there's no place, you know, the only place for her to go with it is to let Mr. Hand know what's going on and put it in his hands, no pun intended.
Yeah. So by this time, there's enough evidence that Todd Hand can get involved. So just tell us a little bit about what happens in terms of these guys. Obviously, there's going to be, these guys are charged. So tell us a little bit more about Todd Hand and what he does with these guys.
Well, the thing is, he decides to, he's certainly going to question them. And for some reason, I always remember the stop sticks. And what happens is, Jeremiah Rogers decides to flee, and the police eventually give chase. And this is eventually going to be a police chase, just like in the movies and on television. And when they finally corner this guy, he holds them off by claiming he's going to kill himself. That's how he holds them off, by claiming he's going to kill himself. Of course, he doesn't need to do it. He just wants to hold the cops off. And, you know, of course, that's not going to work. You know, they're going to stay there as long as possible until they can get him out of the car and arrest him. And they use these stop sticks to eventually stop the car. You know, it's a pretty dramatic scene, certainly the chase.
Now, eventually, these guys are arrested. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that Todd is very, very directed in doing this. And to say something about this case, which is, I didn't write another after I wrote this book. Well, before I wrote the book, I spoke to John Mulchin, M-O-L-C-H-N, who was the state's attorney. And before I left Florida, I said to him, I don't know if I can ever write another true crime book again. It's what happened to Jennifer just has got to me. I identify too much. And I said, I just don't know if I can do this work anymore. And he looked at me, I'll never forget it, and he said, Fred, we speak for the dead. And So I went and I wrote the book, but I didn't write another true crime book for 4 years. I wrote other things. I was able to get into history, which I love writing about. But what John Mulshan said kept going around in my head, Dan, you know, which is, we speak for the dead. And eventually I realized that that was one of the things that I'm called upon to do. And so I got back into writing and investigating true crime, because I realized it's one of the, you know, John was right about it. Ask me a question.
It was traumatic, and I can understand that. The more details in it, of course, you're letting the reader in on this, and it's so vivid that you're almost feeling it, and you're almost experiencing it. So I can only imagine what you go through having to research it and really get close to the families to be able to get this kind of material. And
oh,
the story. So it has to take its toll. If an actor talks about playing some fictional role and it taking its toll, how about in a non-fictional role where you're there with your sleeves rolled up, and this is tragedy at some kind of colossal level, when you talk about Justin's mother looking around and her boyfriend,
right,
and then Jenny's mother right out of high school on really one of her real first dates, really never really had a boyfriend. Everybody wishing the best for their children. Yeah. Just incredible. Very much like every true crime book has to have the trial. And there are no, as we know in true crime books, just when you think it might be a foregone conclusion, it really isn't that simple. The death row, the capital case makes a huge difference on how everything proceeds. But again, in Florida, they're a very serious capital case state, aren't they?
Well, as I pointed out earlier, Justin's death occurs on federal land, which means they have to be tried in a federal court. Whereas with Jenny, it's a state court, and in Florida. Then and now, the only difference is that, you know, then and now, there is capital punishment if you're convicted of murder one. Now, when this occurred, they still had the electric chair. So they would have gone, if they were convicted, they would go to the, you know, to the electric chair. Now, of course, that's changed. They call it the death chamber and all that stuff. But
right,
again, it's you know, it's putting the case together. And nothing is ever a foregone conclusion when you've got 12 women and men who get to pronounce guilt or innocence. You know, nobody, there isn't any prosecutor, for that matter, who goes into something like this expecting that the jury will absolutely, positively see things their way. Because if that were the case, they'd be pretty damn rich by betting in Vegas or whatever. So you just never know how these things can turn out. How do you know that if the defense puts up mitigating evidence about the backgrounds of these individuals, that the jury might take pity on them? Look at what's happening right now in Boston, Massachusetts, where Zokar Tsarnaev is being tried for the Boston Massacre. And the defense is not arguing that he didn't do it. They're going to argue that there are mitigating circumstances during the penalty phase because he's going to be convicted. So you don't know. See, that's the point. You can convict somebody of murder, as you do in this case. But does that mean they're going to give them the death penalty? You don't know. I mean, if a good, you know, a good, terrific, use any adjective you want, defense attorney, they can get somebody off, you know. And if the goal is to put them in the death chamber, it's not going to happen if the defense can make a case for what are called mitigators or mitigating circumstances, whatever those might be.
Certainly. And again, I urge people not to. This is an incredible book from start to finish. Like I mentioned to you, Fred, I usually don't use this term because I think it's too cliche, and lots of times it really isn't true, but this is an absolute page-turner. This book just sucks you in with all the characterization, all the really sad stories, and again, I guess I like these stories where the psychology is just off the charts. These guys are very, very interesting. What I wanted to ask you, too, because I just wanted to mention that these guys, again, have these heroes, you know, Gacy, Nielsen, Son of Sam, and, yeah, maybe it was Bundy, or I'm not sure. So, anyway, which of the serial murders were these psychopathic devotees really enamored with? Because you allude to that in this book.
Boy, oh boy, it's been a while. I want to say Dahmer, because this is too fast. This is back before the, boy, I can't believe this, back before the turn of the century. Dahmer is certainly one of the people that was involved, that they liked. I'm trying to remember, quite frankly. I think also Mr. Bundy.
They like Bundy, but you can, as you can see, that they're one of their favorite movies. And you point this. Well, you mention all of them, and really the only guy that comes out is Dahmer because his favorite movie was Silence of the Lambs. And at that same time as Silence of the Lambs was released, it was the real life horror story of Jeffrey Dahmer.
Right.
And if you're going to eat flesh, there's no bigger role model than Jeffrey Dahmer, I would think.
Well, certainly, yes, I think that's probably true. I mean, that's sort of a conversation that probably there's a whole bunch of other cannibals that we're not recalling. I think Ed Gein is in there, too, but they're enamored of these individuals. And I guess what's so interesting is how up until this happens, it all goes under the radar. Nobody really suspects what these people are capable of doing. And I think that, again, that when they got together, they formed one murderous personality. That's what I think happened. I mean, that was, you know, my impression of the whole thing. But I'll tell you, what I took away from this was just the incredible... the incredible tragedy of the whole thing. I mean, I don't know if you can tell from my voice, but sometimes when I talk about Jennifer, I have to watch myself because I'll start breaking up. Because I
what
keep
I wanted
thinking
to ask
myself.
You.
Go.
Oh, sorry. No.
No.
Finish what you were
saying.
It's okay.
I just was.
I wanted
say,
to
just,
ask
you. Know,
you...
I... Go ahead.
Sorry, there must be an overlap here with our signals. But what I wanted to ask was, when you last spoke to Todd Hand, he was discussing this case many years later with an audience. So tell us a little bit about what about the case he was discussing, and tell us a little bit more about him discussing a case many years later. What was the nature of this meeting that he had, or this talk that he had explaining this case to an audience?
Well, what Todd was explaining to me was he was going to talk about the psychology involved. The psychology involved. And, you know, and how, what, you know, what the, what their cycle, the indications of their psychopathic tendencies. Because in any of these conferences, the idea is to try to show them what these individuals' personalities were, so that in their own, so that when these other police officers are going out and doing their work and so forth, they can spot it and maybe stop it. You know what I mean? And it's, I mean, but you see, we go back to the same thing, which is, that's all well and good, okay? Fine, I can spot a psychopathic personality. What the hell does that mean? It doesn't mean anything unless you find a way to follow the individual. See, that's the problem. These two dudes get released from the state hospital. Nobody follows them. Now, if there was some way of checking in, of following, because they're not, you know, of checking in or whatever, then maybe you can go someplace. You know, because of the fact that we live in a free society, thank God, we can't, just because somebody's got a psychopathic personality, and let's just say for the sake of discussion, it's a situation where Todd is talking to these individuals and says, okay, look for this, you know, and then the next thing you know, fade out, fade in, a cop sees some dude and he beats the crap out of somebody and he says, oh, that's a psychopath. Okay, fine, the guy's a psychopath. So now you charge him with assault and battery or something like that. Okay. But what happens from that point onward? Is the individual going to get some sort of therapy? Are they going to put them on medication? What are they going to do? You see what I'm saying? There's an inherent flaw in the system here in this country where we're all about punishment. We're not about prevention. We're about punishment. How do you let's talk about preventing it, guys. Let's talk about preventing it. You know, the best way of explaining where I'm coming from is to say that Lee Harvey Oswald went to junior high school in the Bronx, New York. And you know what happened? He was taken to the school shrink who said he's a psychopath. For one, you know, he acted out in some way. And this is in Gerald Posner's book, Case Closed. And when I read that, I couldn't believe it. Because all I said to myself is, wait a second, this guy's a psychopath. What'd they do about it? Well, they didn't do anything about it. See my point? It's like, what do you do?
You know, Fred?
You follow somebody physically, but, yeah, go ahead, I'm sorry.
I have a whole problem. I have a whole problem with Robert Hare's whole idea about this psychopathic personality, which means not only are we talking about Jeffrey Dahmer and Ted Bundy and these guys. No, we're talking about your boss. You're talking about yourself because it's so generalized to say that somebody doesn't have remorse. All of us don't have remorse all the time or empathy. We can be self-centered. We can be selfish. We can be cruel different times of our life. What I think is that what you're talking about is the only thing you can get from these people and getting the, very much like I did with the killer that I profiled in my book, you get a glimpse of how these people really, really think. And
mm-hmm. Yes.
It's rare to not have that buffered by these people lying to get out eventually or lying to avoid the death penalty or very much like Jeremiah did initially, try to put the blame on his partner. But really, when you get this opportunity, and this is an opportunity where you see a list and to see a really good glimpse into the mindset of these psychopathic killers, and that's the difference. They're psychopathic killers, not just psychopaths.
Go ahead, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, we need to make a differentiation between a sociopathic personality, which is different from a psychopathic personality. The words have been used interchangeably, but they're not. When we talk about sociopaths, we're talking about exactly what you were saying. Individuals you'll see in the course of your daily lives who have no, who don't feel any guilt, who don't feel empathy. Well, that doesn't mean they're going to go out and kill somebody. But when you have a psychopathic personality, criminal tendencies, there's your difference. There's your difference that they'll act out in that respect. Now, I mean, it's certainly beyond, you know, my powers to say what you're going to do when you identify these individuals, except maybe find a way to track them, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know. You know, we talk. That's almost talk. You know, then we're getting again into sort of a futuristic kind of thing. You know what I mean? Preventing the crime before it happens.
Well, like science fiction. Canada believes in
exactly.
that kind of stuff. But the science fiction of rehabilitating everyone, no matter what, either with drugs
exactly.
or through talk therapy. But my point is that I think what Todd Hand can learn and what you have learned and anybody that reads this book, and a lot of this audience is criminologists and students of law and some lawyers, but people that are very, very interested in the law. And I think what we can find is that when we have an understanding of this mindset, you got to think the normal police procedure when they encounter a person like this and they're not familiar with these type of personalities is when you've got a body in the back like Jeffrey Dahmer had. He coolly can deal with the police because he is a psychopathic character that's cool, calm, and collect. Where a police officer's trained to deal and sense or recognize when a person is usually lying, usually is under
right.
pressure. So almost everyone, 99,000, you know, I mean, 99% of the people are not going to be feel cool and calm and easily get out of a jam like a body in the back seat. But what we can learn is that when police are initially interviewing guys like this that seem
right.
to be, there's no, wow, we don't have any warrant, we don't have any real grounds, that we can, you could see that behavior for what it is and what it may not be. And I think that's what the only thing we can learn. In terms of prevention, it's like a movie when we recognize that the psychopathic but with criminal tendencies exactly define what criminal tendencies would be. And what would we do if a guy was lighting fires and breaking into homes and beating up dogs? I mean, what would we legally be able to do? You know, and again, when you say that it's, you know, we're talking about a draconian system in a lot of areas anyway, so I think we would be on a very slippery slope of a draconian
exactly.
system if we start,
you're right.
you know. So I think there's no such thing as prevention. I think the only thing can happen is if, again, with responsible family, when somebody said, listen, I'm fantasizing about killing people,
yeah.
most families would know if their son was reading KKK literature or devil worshiping. I mean, again, you can't really, you know, you can't legislate responsible
That's
parenting
right.
or anything like that. So I think the only thing you can learn is that when you're talking to these people, despite their good looks, despite their charm, despite they look harmless, they may be the exact opposite of all those three things.
I couldn't say it any better. No wonder you're a terrific writer.
No, Fred, I really, really love this book. There's so much more for the audience to read in this jam-packed action, nonfiction examination of two very, very interesting killers and a very, very sad backdrop of the families of Justin and Jennifer and all the people that were involved that these people touched their lives. They're very, very, again, it's a very extreme example of how innocent some people are that get killed, the most undeserving, if not that there is any deserving people. Fred, what I wanted to ask too is that what are you working on now? I know we won't mention anything about a case that people have asked for updates, but we won't be talking about that. But what are you working on right now? And let us know. And tell us a little bit more about this reissue that's brought this great book back to everyone's attention with the reissue.
Sure. Well, first, as far as the book is concerned, Flesh Collectors has been republished by Open Road, Open Road Media, as an ebook and as well as a print on demand, and very affordably priced, I might add. It's also going to be an Audible book, and they've republished a lot of my backlist, meaning a lot of older books that I've done. That haven't been out for a couple of years. At the same time, I'm working on a book about about the murder of President James Garfield. And I'm going to name the real murderer in the book, and it's not the person that history says murdered him.
And I
got access to certain information, and even though it's a little bit perhaps, I'm going to nail the murderer. And I've got the help of the president's great-great-grandson. He's been very helpful in helping me with this. And so I'm working on this book, and it'll be out sometime next year.
Wow, what a scoop. That sounds amazing. So it'll be another good reason to speak to you about that. I mean, that's incredible. We've had a few historical crimes that just, it's amazing the stuff that's unearthed thanks to the internet. It really helps.
Exactly.
People aren't spending their life at the library. So it's incredible. If people want to find out all the list of the fantastic true crime books you have written so far and would like to maybe even send you a message or a note, how would they contact you and find out more about Fred Rosen?
Well, first off, if you're interested in any of the books that I've written, just go to Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com, type in my name, Fred Rosen, and all the books will come up, list of the books. Or you can go to openroadmedia.com, which is their website, so you can get it from those places. And if you'd like to get in touch with me, that's a pretty easy thing to do. Just go to Facebook, look up Fred Rosen, and just send me an email. You know, I think that's called an email, right? And just send me an email.
Sure.
I'd love to hear from you.
Oh, great. Well, I want to thank you very much, Fred, for coming back on, and it's always a pleasure. And this book is, I just had a fantastic time reading this book. I wish it was maybe three or four times as long so that I could have read it for more than just a couple days, because, man, it was a page-turner. So thank you very much, Fred, for coming on and talking about this very, very touching, and I know still very tender. You know, you're still, it's still emotional.
Well,
I can hear that emotionality in your voice over
this. Well, it's always a pleasure to speak with you, because you know so much and you're so smart, and I'm not just, you know, kissing your you-know-what. It's just that, you know, when you do enough of this work, you begin to realize there are some people who get it and some don't, and you really get it, and I think you do a service for the listeners, because you point them, I'm not talking about myself, but some of the other authors that you've had on, like Mr. Burl Bearer and others, you point them in the right direction to individuals who are really committed to writing good stuff, and I thank you for that.
Well, I just feel like I'm just privileged to be a part of this true crime community of the fans, the fantastic writers, the people like Burl Bear that do it all, basically have a radio show as well, the new generation of stuff that's, again, Generation Y, Sword and Scale, Crime Beat, some really good shows, and it's a really good community of true crime authors, fans, people that appreciate true crime, and people that are helping support that whole thing. So I just feel privileged, and I know the audience is very appreciative. I get messages from all over the world talking about enjoying the interviews with the authors and the fantastic stories that therein lie in these books. So I want to thank you very much again, Fred. You have yourself a great evening.
You too, sir. Thank you very much.
Good night. This episode is over, and it means it's time to get your free snacks delivered right to your door from naturebox.com. With over 100 options to choose from, get the bold flavors you crave and feel smarter about snacking. Go to naturebox.com/truemurder to start your free sample trial today. That's naturebox.com/truemurder. Good night.